Shooting it raw?
Yes. Shooting it raw.
That's an interesting question. I would say I love taking photographs. Now, I'm by no means a photographer, but you're right. With the technology that we have nowadays, it's really easy to take snapshots. And I did dabble with a lot of painting when I was younger. So I love framing. And I guess what it means to me is you can capture a special moment. I do a lot of gardening. And one of my favorite pictures that I took with my phone is of my poppies. And they would bloom here around the end of May, early June. And it had just rained, and there were water droplets on the poppy. And I zoomed in really closely, and you could see the water droplets on the inside of the petals. And it just was so beautiful. And I think that nowadays, we enjoy images more than we ever did before because that technology is available to us. Whereas before, you know, 100-odd years ago, it was a very special thing for a photograph to be taken, and people look so prim and proper, you know, very serious, because this was a serious event. And we've come to, all of us, become very relaxed, I think, in front of the camera and in video as well, because this has become the norm. It's become part of our life's existence in this day and age.
Angela Van Bremen. Yes, that's how I see your name, Angela Van Bremen?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yes. If you were in Holland, you would say Van Bremen, but here we say Van Bremen. So that's perfect.
Van Bremen?
Oh, perfect. Well done.
Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
Thank you. Yeah, like welcome to Shooting It Raw, the podcast, where somehow we're going to get to the question directly or indirectly. Like, we have a certain allotment of seconds in our life, in our lives, and how do we spend them? How do we make the every second count? How do we basically try to inspire the listener to kind of go, oh, well, this is another way that somebody is making sense of their lives. That's kind of how we're just going to talk about your four images that you sent through. I haven't looked at them. I don't research my guests. I sometimes ramble and then I say, there's a question there, over to you. And you'll be like, what? Okay. But we're going to have a great conversation. That's my promise to you.
Excellent. Very good.
Where are you in the world?
I'm in Ontario, Canada. I live north of Toronto by about an hour's drive in the country. So I'm secluded here with
really?
Forest, wildlife, nature, which reflects my soul perfectly. So I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, wicked. You know I'm Canadian, right?
No, I did not. Wow.
Yeah, I lived in Toronto for a few years, in fact. So which city do you live in?
Well, I live in the country, so there's no direct city, but the area is considered Loreto. It's considered the city, but the heart of Loreto is actually a very tiny hamlet and is actually about 10 kilometers north of here. So I'm literally in the country, but I am a little bit
nice.
East of Orangeville and west of Newmarket. South of Alliston and north of Bolton, if that helps pinpoint it for you, if you remember those little towns at all.
That's great. Well, you know, represent for Canada, very nice. Okay, well, let's dive into your first photo. So what I have here is, it looks like, I guess, a artwork for it's a music CD cover. It says, yes. Angela Van Bremen on the
yes.
top. And then it says, In the Breeze.
Yes.
In the Breeze, Celtic-inspired music.
Correct.
It's a photo of you looking to your left, or when we're looking, you're looking off, yes. like straight to the right.
Yes.
Your face isn't quite in profile, but mm-hmm. you're wearing this very nice kind of black blouse of sorts.
Yeah, it's a lacy blouse.
And it's like behind the sort of the background is this kind of fade from white down to kind of dark orange at the bottom. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your expression is you're just looking, you're wearing black eyeliner in the breeze. So what is In the Breeze, Celtic inspired music?
Well, it's been a lifelong dream of mine to produce a CD and an album, really, although I have some friends who are old school who wanted me to also produce CDs. So I do have a number of CDs that I did get manufactured specifically for those folks. But it's available on Spotify and Apple and all the other major online music stores. But basically, In the Breeze, I've been trained in opera, but I have always loved Celtic music. So basically, this is a culmination of work that I've done with several people. I'm the vocalist, but I had some wonderful partnerships with several people, namely Cynthia Fox Fucile, who is my vocal coach and a wonderful friend. I've also worked with, and the main producer is Red Egg Studio by Mars Giamarco. He's an Emmy winner. And also when Mars heard that I wanted to do a Celtic-inspired CD, he said, well, you have to work with Jason Wilson. And Jason Wilson is a two-time Juno nominee. So I was really honored to work with these stellar people. And the interpretations and the musical backgrounds that they created for the traditional pieces like Loch Lomond and A Fond Kiss and Wild Mountain Time were just phenomenal. It was so much fun working with them. But what I was particularly proud about is I write poetry as well. And so three of my songs have been set to music. The first one is Do You Hear the Drums? And this is an interesting story. I have a friend of my husband and I have a friend who is named Casey Cole. And he's a fantastic musician, but most musicians do have regular jobs in order to make ends meet. And he has a fantastic house painting business. And he was over one day doing some work for us. And he's always telling me what new project he's working on. And he says, Angela, you have to hear this hand pan drum. And he started playing. And the moment Casey started playing, the words, the melody just popped in my head and I started singing.
Oh, nice.
And so over a year and a half, we worked on that particular song. It was so exciting and so original to have this piece just come from the etheric. It was just awesome. Mm-hmm. So that was the first piece. The second piece is also based on my poetry. This particular song is called I Will Be in the Breeze, which is the inspiration for the title of the CD. And this particular song ended up being quite contemporary and avant-garde. My friend Raina Valcourt read this particular poem. She says, I have a melody in my head. And so the music is very unusual and very challenging musically to sing. So it really was wonderful to accomplish this beautiful piece. And the third piece was as a result of a challenge from the local writers group that I belong to called the Wordsmiths. And they are based out of Alliston, Ontario. And it was during COVID. And so we would meet by Zoom twice a month. And the challenge was to write something about the sea. So I had it in my head to write a sea shanty. And as I was writing the sea shanty poem, I could feel and hear the music and the rhythm just coming through to me. So that was my third original piece. So of the 11 songs on the album, it's really delightful and rewarding to me to also have three original pieces. So that is a quick summary of In the Breeze.
Okay.
It was a real delight to work on this project. Some ideas for new songs and hope to do another album next year.
Because like, so I'm just kind of a nerdy kind of person who's kind of like, oh, that's interesting. And that's interesting. So classically trained in opera, but why Celtic inspired music? Like, what is it about Celtic music that drew you there? Because Is that just something that you've kind of been drawn to? Because it's not quite what one would kind of connect with opera. Or is it?
Well, it can be. Some pieces can be quite operatic. It depends on how you treat it. What was interesting about this piece is Jason and Mars at one point said, "Can you take the opera out of some of these pieces? Can you sing it in a lighter tone, sing it a little differently?" That was fun to do. Like, for me, that was really musically challenging to take a different approach. And and they basically said, "Can you sing it more poppy?" And I did sing it more pop style. Right. Boy, was that a blast to do. That was so much fun.
Nice.
The reason why I love Celtic music so much is a lot of people have asked me this question. I said, "But you're Dutch. Both your parents are Dutch. Why Celtic?" And I got to thinking about it. First of all, every time I hear it, my heart just starts singing. There's just something about it that my heart, my soul just leaps towards it. But I also know that I may have been influenced without realizing it as a child, because my mother's her middle brother. So my uncle, Bert, he married a Scots woman. And so at family gatherings, we would often visit and go to events where there was Scottish dancing and where there was the Scottish music being played. And so I think this is when I really fell in love with Celtic music in general. And also my parents would play it a lot on the records, you know, at home. So I think I have an affinity toward it. I love it so very much. But I think that I also did get steeped into that culture sort of through osmosis because of my uncle.
Right. So I know this is unfair because it's also, you know, Shooting It Raw. It's kind of like a little bit of whatever happens. Hopefully by the end of this hour, the talking that you're doing is warming up your voice. And what are the chances that you're going to share a bit of your singing voice with us? Maybe a few bars.
I won't have music to accompany me because I wasn't prepared for that, but certainly I can sing. I'd be delighted to.
Oh, that would be my greatest honor. Okay, so In the Breeze, so you also write poetry. So what you don't know about me, or it's just because we met, is that my first degree was in creative writing. So poetics and writing, writing and poetics to me are very big parts of my thinking and my approach to life and aesthetic. So who is born first, the writer in you or the singer?
The writer, I think.
Yeah.
But when you write poetry, there's a cadence, there's a rhythm. Even when you write prose, there's a cadence and rhythm, which is very musical, if you think about it. And so when you have a reader who's enjoying reading prose, so reading a book, and then all of a sudden the rhythm stops, something's happened with that musical element to it. So I think it's hard to separate one from the other. But I think in my early days, like if I'm thinking about 5, 6 years old, always humming, but honestly, the writing came first. If I think about some of my first poems, they were when I was around 10 or 11 years old. And I had an unfortunate thing happen when I was 6 years of age in school, so I didn't sing in public because I had an unfortunate situation where I was told that I didn't sound very good when I was singing. And so I was a bit of a closet singer. I sang when no one could hear. And so I really think the two have always been in conjunction with each other, but certainly putting pen to paper happened first.
Nice. Great. I will maybe add a link to one of your tracks if it's on Spotify so people can listen.
It's going to be released on April 16th, so it may not be available just yet, but depending on when you air this, it may very well be ready. But if not, I can send you an MP3 file.
That's very exciting. Well, since you said MP3 file, I guess we have to go on to the next photo.
Okay.
Okay, so here we go. So in your mind, you know, and I always marvel about this, because basically my experience and the experience of the listener is to go on this like, well, what's the next photo going to be? You know, like we don't know what it could be. It could be a pirate or whatever. But here it's a monarch butterfly on a potentially not a rose bush, maybe a rhododendron. Half of the flowers are kind of dead and dying, but half are bright. The monarch, it's a nice shot, probably done with your phone in terms of it's on the background that's out of focus is like a deck. The more than a third about half of the image is just this close up shot of the black and white sort of white polka dot black body. And then the bright orange wings of the monarch. And so now I have to ask, why, Angela, why?
Well, I rescue monarch butterflies when they are in the larvae state. As you probably are aware, they are endangered. And so what I do is I have a lot of gardens so that I encourage natural habitat all over our property. But there are times when, and they only eat, the larvae only eat milkweed. And a lot of farmers, they pull the milkweed out of their fields. So the food source is really not there. So I really encourage it on our property. But they spread through runners once these milkweed plants are established. And so they will go outside the boundaries of my garden into the lawn. And so what happens is when my husband is ready to mow the lawn, I say, wait, hold on. Hold on, hold on. And I go through all of the grass. And if I see any shoots that are coming up, I examine those leaves. Because most of the time, the female monarchs will lay their eggs on the most tender of shoots. And invariably, I will find eggs under the leaves of these milkweed plants. Wow. So then what I do is I have a license with... You can't raise them without having a license. So I'm a member of the Toronto Entomologists Association, T. And so under that license, we are allowed to raise monarchs. I have a very natural setting where I have a sort of an outdoor mesh where I keep living milkweed plants. And so once I have taken a cutting because it was in the lawn, then I put them into little, they're sort of like florist tubes, and I put them into the pot with the larger plants. And I just let the larvae grow. And they go through five stages, what they call instar stages, until they're ready to go into chrysalis. And from chrysalis, then eventually they eclose as a monarch butterfly. But I do everything outside. I don't coddle. I keep them in the same environment that they would be. I just save them from the lawnmower blades. So it's a passion of mine to save these little things because it's certainly not their mama's fault that they got that their eggs were placed on on something destined for mowing.
Well, okay. So I had no idea this is where you're going to take us. Monarchs. What? Okay. Now, I immediately have to ask, like, it's against the law to raise monarchs? Like, you need to be, it's a regulated thing?
Yes, it's regulated because, unfortunately, there are a lot of people who mean well. They think that they're saving them because they know that they're endangered. And what happens is they end up raising them in mass quantities. And really, it's survival of the fittest. So, for example, in nature, of 100 eggs that are laid, only one or two will actually become butterflies because they have natural predators and other things that happen in the environment when man is not involved, obviously. So some people are the philosophy, let's save all of them because they're endangered. But what happens is if you collect 100 eggs and you raise them in crowded, probably not the cleanest of conditions, you're not necessarily raising healthy monarchs. You may be raising monarchs with diseases. And so the reason why they regulate, in fact, they regulate all wildlife really in Ontario, most provinces, really all provinces, people cannot raise animals in captivity. And the monarchs fall under the Ministry of Natural Resources rules as well, as including swallowtail, like swallowtail tiger, tiger swallowtail butterflies as well. So yeah, it's regulated for their protection.
Angela, like, I am blown away because, okay, so one of the things about being Canadian, I think that really stands out, and not to say that other countries aren't like this at all, but I live in Hong Kong, right? Okay, so I'm a bit of a weirdo too, I guess. I'm a bit of a nerd. So consider how, have you ever been to Hong Kong?
No, I haven't, but we have a dear friend who goes all the time.
Right. I think Canada, in terms of Canada's size, is about, I don't know, how many thousands of times bigger than Hong Kong. Hong Kong is basically the size of Greater Toronto area, right? Yes. Like, I think Toronto, all the proper, all of, with all the suburbs and everything, is bigger than Hong Kong. Yes. Hong Kong has 7.5 million people. Okay. In all of Canada, there are about 300 species of butterfly. In I remember looking this up one time, and in Hong Kong, which is so tiny, it has more species of butterfly that come in, live, are regularly here than in the whole of Canada. So
how cool is that?
So it's fellow nerd. Oh, yeah, it's
fantastic.
Amazing. It's amazing.
Wow, that's amazing.
So what drew you? Okay, so when did you first learn about well, obviously monarchs really, really stand out. Like, it's kind of like absolutely incredible. They're such a signature visible species. So when did you first get interested, and have you ever been down to Mexico to witness their congregations?
Oh, I wish. I have been to Mexico, but not to see them in their overwintering areas. But it is pretty phenomenal if you ever look at the photographs. I mean, there's just clusters of them everywhere. And you see something similar when they're getting ready to migrate. They do congregate at Peely Point in Western Ontario. And it's just fascinating, just fascinating. I guess everybody is fascinated by these beautiful creatures because of the distance that they travel. And they travel it all in one go, pretty much. And some of them do travel back, but most of them, when they come back after overwintering, it's more multi-generational. So the ones that overwintered in Mexico don't necessarily make the entire trip back. Some might, but most of it's multi-generational. So they sort of travel in waves. And as they're ready, so it's very important that, you know, you don't see any natural disasters. Like you heard a number of years ago in Texas, there were some terrible, I think there was some really cold weather that happened and plants died off that were key nectar sources for the monarchs. And this could happen as they start migrating. There's two migrating points that they end up going to: South California area as well as Mexico. So the ones from Western Canada tend to go obviously to California. The ones from Ontario, Eastern Canada basically go to Mexico. And so it's just interesting, but they do multi-generational on the way back. So I find that very interesting. They're just amazing creatures, which is the other reason why when people are raising monarchs, they want that 1 or 2% to be the strongest because they've really survived everything. And they want those to be the best of the best because they've got a long journey to go to. And that's the other reason why it's best not to interfere. The only time I do is when I'm rescuing them from certain death. Otherwise, there's nothing more joyous. You know, I'm working in my garden. And what I do with my vegetable garden is I don't have just straight vegetables. I'll have patches of flowers intermittent throughout it. And so what that basically mm-hmm. does is I'm attracting pollinators this way to the flowers as well as to my vegetable plants. And so I might be picking some tomatoes and then I look over and I see the milkweed plant and there is a beautiful monarch caterpillar enjoying lunch. You know, so that's very joyous to me. I find that fascinating, really interesting. So I try to keep the habitat really natural for them.
I never know what's going to happen in our conversations, like in these podcast conversations. I'm just like, okay, caterpillars, monarchs, this is great, Angela. You want to move on to the next image, or do you want...
No, it's fine. I tried to pick some eclectic type of pictures that were representatives of my personality, and I thought you might enjoy that.
No, this is great. This is great. Well, let's move on to the next photo. Okay, this is more of a kind of like a banner art. Yes. How do I say that? Procyon?
Procyon.
Procyon Wildlife.
Yes, you said it perfectly.
Oh, look at that. I speak English. Working to preserve Ontario wildlife in their natural habitat. Voted 2021 Wildlife Rehab Center of the Year. Okay, make a difference, get involved, help us in your hands. It's all in our hands. Okay, and on it is a photo of a red-tailed fox, somebody holding, I think it's a bat or a frog. I don't know. And then there's another photo of a deer eating leaves, another photo of could be a marten, another photo of a porcupine, then a skunk, then a raccoon. This is so Ontario. I love it. I love it. Okay. What is Procyon Wildlife?
Well, that is a cause extremely dear to my heart. I've been a volunteer for Procyon Wildlife for 8 years. And basically what we do is we rescue, rehabilitate, and release injured and orphaned wildlife. So if wildlife's been orphaned or hurt by, hit by a car or some other sort of injury, then we will take them into our center, heal them, and then release them back to Mother Nature where they're intended to be. So it's a cause that I've been involved in for quite some time now. The last 3 years I've been one of the directors for Procyon Wildlife. So it's a big part of my life, which is why I thought it was a representative thing.
Yeah.
As one of the photos.
So you have a center?
Yes, we do. It's in Beaton, Ontario. Yeah. So it's on 4 acres. Mm-hmm. And we rehabilitate fox, coyote, raccoons, squirrels. We're now starting all Ontario wildlife, basically. We haven't done too much in the way of birds, although we're starting to work mm-hmm. on developing aviaries to take care of mm-hmm. more birds. So we now have Edgar the Raven, who is a new resident, a permanent resident.
Oh, wow.
We had to get a special license from the Ministry of Natural Resources in order to be allowed to have Edgar on hand. So he's an educational bird. Mm-hmm. And then we also have Rusty the red-tailed hawk. So those are our residents.
Okay.
All the other animals in our care are released.
Where does the funding come from? How do you survive?
Well, it's tough. It's tough because we don't receive government funding. We do get grants from generous organizations in some cases, but mainly we rely on donations from the public and from corporations. And last year, for the first time, we had a fundraising gala in December 1st, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was very successful. And so this year we are going to hold another fundraising gala, which will be on November the 23rd.
Right. What does Procyon mean?
Procyon is Latin for raccoon. So mainly the center started out taking care of raccoons, but as time went on, then we began to take on other animals as well. The full name in Latin is Procyon lotor, but generally we just say Procyon Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. So.
Mm-hmm. What is the most... Okay, so at one point I brought... I tried to move back to Canada. So I went back to... ended up in Victoria, BC. And in order to get there... Or not in order to get... In order to start the move, I brought two of my dogs and two of my cats with me. That was a difficult time, actually, to move four animals and to live in Victoria. And then because I had to go to the vet, I went and I spoke to the vet there and I said, what is the most unexpected, crazy, exotic wildlife that that you've seen? And he looked at me and goes, well, that's easy. It was Siberian tiger cubs. And I was like, what?
Wow, how cool.
Yeah, and so a circus was going through and one of the Siberian tiger mothers had given birth. And so he's like, yeah, I had to care for like four of these, well, just look at these four cubs. And it was crazy. Now, back to Procyon Wildlife. How involved are you with how directly involved are you with the animals? Because you don't want to handle them too much. What experience or what, rescue occurred that really stands out when you think about it?
What rescue that stands out? I can give you an interesting example of something that happened last year. Fortunately, there's a lot of kind-hearted people that will get the animals to us. But other times, there are people who are not so kind. I am more on the administrative side, working with Procyon, although I have worked directly with animals as well. But the people who are the real heroes at the center are the ones who do the animal care. But I can tell you about a story which is a little bit sad, although it had a beautiful ending. Our winters are changing. And so last year, it was extremely mild, as it was this year. And the earliest baby raccoons were discovered. Someone, I guess, had found them in an attic. And they were still had eyes closed, hardly any fur on them. And they were dumped in a snowbank in Toronto. And so the people who found them were absolutely desperate. There were three found. The people who found them were absolutely desperate. And they found us. And so the babies were brought in a snowstorm to Procyon. And our animal care workers did a beautiful job taking care of them. One didn't make it. Their names, because of where they were found, Frosty, Blizzard, and Snowflake. And so one didn't make it, but the other two ended up growing into beautiful, fat, healthy raccoons that ended up being released. So that's an example. Another one, if you go to our website, you can find one about a beautiful fox named Talitha. And Talitha was found one cold April morning, just shivering on someone's front lawn. A little baby fox, again, eyes closed, just shivering. And she was brought to the center and cared for and eventually released as well. So some of the animals that come to us as, orphaned, abandoned for some reason, not deliberately by their moms. One of the biggest problems is that people will have a raccoon in the attic and they get rid of the adult, not realizing there's babies left behind. And so then it's quite tragic if someone like Procyon isn't found to take over the role of mama. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Our main director, Deborah Spillar, I think one of the most interesting rescues she had that I can think of, although she's had many, is one time the OPP called and said, there's an injured deer on the side of the road. She ended up getting that deer. They helped get that deer into her pickup truck and into the back. She's got an extended cab. And she drove that deer wrapped up tightly in a blanket to the center. So our people are so dedicated. They would do anything to save an animal.
Mm-hmm. I can just imagine the deer who's like, what is happening to me? it's just like, obviously traumatized.
Yeah, we were scared he would wake up. And he did wake up a little bit, but And I think it was a bit of a job getting him out because he came to a little bit more, but it turned out okay for it.
Sure. So does Procyon serve all of Ontario? No, just the Toronto area? Like what's the scope? What's the geographical footprint?
We cover north of Toronto. We do take Toronto animals sometimes. Like in the case of the ones in January, that was a special situation, but there's another center called Toronto Wildlife Center. So they handle most of Toronto, but we handle a huge geographic area. We go as far as Markham, Thornhill, to the north, Midland, Midhurst, Owen Sound, to the west, Kitchener, Waterloo area, and just the most northern part of Mississauga, little bit of northern of Toronto, but not too much. Like, so it's a huge area that we cover.
Yeah, it is huge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. So how, okay. So who was born first? The singer, the writer? So far we know it's the writer, or is it the animal conservationist? Like,
well, that's,
are you the kid who showed up with a kitten in her hands? Like what?
Well, not kittens, but I was that kid. So the first one was a chicken. My sister and I were walking in the conservation area, and there was this chicken walking around very bewildered, a little white chicken, and it was missing an eye. And it was walking in circles. So I carried that home. That was a pet chicken. Then a pet raccoon. I shouldn't say pet raccoon because even all those years ago, I was 16 years old. I knew this raccoon had to go back to the wild, but we did everything we could to rehabilitate her. There weren't any wildlife centers in those days. That's a relatively new thing in the span of my lifetime, but we did successfully release her back to the wild. So that was a very successful release. My saddest situation where I could not rescue, my parents put the brakes on that one, was two baby skunks that we found in the conservation area. Oh, their mother had died. She was in a ditch. And my mom and dad said no to the baby skunks. And didn't matter if my sister asked, didn't matter if my mom, if I asked, didn't matter who we asked, the answer was no. So we weren't able to do anything for those two little creatures. So I would say that probably my whole life, that's been a thread that has been, throughout my whole life, respecting and loving wildlife. And so I came really full circle when I found Procyon.
So let's say somebody shows up at Procyon with an injured skunk. For listeners who don't know what a skunk is, right? Like, I mean, where I lived in Montreal and where a little bit in Toronto, for me, the smell of skunk is so signature. It's so unique. And it's so, like, of course, funky and strong and all this stuff. And I've never been sprayed. But I've had dogs that were sprayed. I had my dog was sprayed. And it is so intense, right? So do people actually bring sort of injured skunk to Procyon to rehabilitate? And is like how does staff manage dealing with a injured skunk who could turn around at any moment and defensively spray?
Well, they do. We do. Generally, what happens is people need to phone our center first to make sure that we are not at capacity.
Yeah.
Because we're all volunteer based, so we can only take care of as many animals as we have volunteers that come in. So that's the first thing. They need to call first. But absolutely, we take care of skunks. In fact, if you ask our volunteers, they are probably one of the sweetest, most gentle creatures to care for. They're very docile.
They really are.
Yeah, they're very sweet. And the other ones that are extremely sweet are porcupines as well. And I think it's because they have these built-in defensive mechanisms that they don't have to be as aggressive as maybe another animal that doesn't have the quills or doesn't have the the ability to clear a room in a hurry. they do get skunked sometimes, you know, the volunteers, occasionally it does happen. Like you'll walk into the center sometimes and it's like, oh, okay. But you get used to the smell quite quickly, actually, and then you don't notice it.
Yep. So just so that you know, a little story, China, Asia, there's the Asian skunk, or no, not skunk, sorry, porcupine. And the Asian porcupine, I believe, is smaller than the Canadian one. And out here, they smell like ginger because they eat ginger roots. Oh. So when you see a porcupine, it's amazing because you smell it. You smell the air and it's like, and they're so fun. They're so kind of like, they're like ordinary old men who just walk around kind of grumpily going, bah, 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 and they smell like ginger. It's amazing.
That is so interesting. Wow.
Bet you didn't expect that to come out of this conversation.
No, I didn't. And I think this is fascinating. I love that. I'm going to go do some more research after we chat. Yeah. That is really interesting.
Okay. Well, I guess we should move on to the next photo. Where are you taking us, Angela? This is great.
I don't know. We'll see. Where it's number four.
Okay. Angela van Bremen. Past Life's Revenge, a David Harris and Emma Jackson mystery. So you wrote a book.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Wicked. With David Harris or no, what? I'm confused. A David Harris and Emma Jackson mystery.
Yes.
But it's written by you. Yes. Past Life's Revenge. Yes. Link in the show notes, all that kind of stuff. In it, so this is an image of a book cover. So yes. In the foreground, in focus, is this man kind of holding, you only see the back of the woman's head, right?
Yes.
So the man is looking at the photographer. It looks like a, you know, good Canadian shot because he's wearing a kind of winter coat. She's wearing a winter coat. He's kind of hugging her slightly menacingly. Like there's this menace in his eyes. And in the background, kind of like a photoshopped illustration, is a blurred out silhouette, black on blue gray, kind of fuzzy, with a hand kind of,
yes,
it's very menacing, right? So it's like,
yes,
the image is stark and menacing. Past Life's Revenge is in orange and revenge is in sort of bright red.
Yes.
Okay, Angela, take us to school. What's Past Life's Revenge?
Well, it's an idea I had for a story that probably began about 40 years ago. I always have considered myself a poet. Maybe I write the odd short story, but I never contemplated writing a book. Although in my early 20s, I started to dabble with this story, started to write it, and then midway through, I kind of just stopped. I got busy with work. I met my husband, who I've been married to for 35 years now, and things just got, life got busy. And so I kept writing poetry, sure, but I put the manuscript aside, and then every year or so I'd pull it out of the desk and I'd look at it and I'd think, yeah, and I'd put it away again. And a year and a half ago, well, not even that long ago, in December of 2022, I pulled it out of the desk again and I looked at it and I thought, why don't you look at it at least instead of just, you know, glancing at it and shoving it back in the drawer?
Mm-hmm.
So I started reading it and I thought, well, this is interesting. I remember this concept, this idea that I had. And so I thought, needs fixing, needs a lot of rewrite, but why don't I write it? So I used what I had written all those years ago as a bit of an outline, until I got to the middle and then it was like, oh, now what? And then I just kept on going. It was a lot of fun. So the premise is this. David Harris is a young lawyer. He's almost 30 years old. He's had nightmares his entire life and unsettling nightmares and visions and doesn't understand why. He sought all kinds of treatment through conventional medicine. Nothing's helped. Then one day he meets a lovely young woman. Her name is Emma Jackson. And he's smitten with her almost right away. And it turns out that she's a psychic. And pretty soon she begins to get this sense that maybe these dreams and visions are coming from not some childhood trauma, but maybe from something that happened before in a previous life. So she encourages him to get a past life regression, which he does. And during that regression, during a series of several, actually, he realizes that he was murdered, and he was only murdered 30 years ago, which means that his killer is possibly still alive. So then he becomes, so even though he had hoped and Emma had hoped that he would get closure just knowing the explanation for these terrible visions and dreams, which stopped once he had that explanation, he's now been replaced with this burning desire to exact revenge. And after some research, he realizes that killer is indeed alive. And so the premise of the story then is to go after this killer before he kills more innocent victims.
Ah, 30 years later. Okay. So this is your first book? I'm assuming it's your first book?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. It is indeed.
Okay. And it was published. When was it published?
It is going to be published on July the 9th. Right now, it is already on Amazon and any other online stores for pre-sale. So you can do pre-orders on it.
Okay.
But it won't be released until the 9th of July. So it's brand new.
Okay, well, congratulations. Congratulations. So, okay, so why don't you talk about, because the thing with poetry or poetics, whatever, is like, in a way, it's about capturing a moment. And it, and it almost, look, of course, there are long poems and there are epic poems. And, you know, of course, there's poetry that'll completely contradict what I'm about to say. But in a way, it's about capturing the essence of a moment or an experience, but then shifting gears to writing a novel is about extending and connecting long moments together. So how would you describe the difference in terms of the writing process?
There is a huge difference. And I embrace the challenge of writing a book because I didn't think that that was in me. I thought this book would at best be a novella originally. To go back to the poetry, I've always considered poetry as if you are painting with words. And so what I mean by that is you don't need a lot of words to paint that feeling, that emotion, whether it's fear or love or awe of nature. And a lot of my poetry is based on nature themes. But you don't need a lot of words. If you choose the right, well-placed word, it's just incredible. You can say so much with so few words. So switching to writing a novel, I think that's probably why year after year I was putting a manuscript down so often, because I didn't think that was in me. And I don't know what changed, but what I found is that I started building on it. So I had a good, decent, outline. I found that I built on it. So when I got to certain areas where I realized it isn't enough just to say this or that, I need to build in character. I need to build in more description, but in particular dialogue, which I had fun exploring and working on. And because you can say so much with dialogue. And I just found it was a very different process, but I really enjoyed it. But I found that it was like layering. So I would have the basic story, and I've already started book two, and I'm at about chapter 19. And I'm finding the same thing. I'm finding the same thing as developing where I'm writing. I'm just getting it down first because you've got to get it down first. You can worry about editing and finessing later. But I'm finding that the same process is occurring where I'm writing, once it's done, then I'm finding then I can build on. So a certain thing or an idea that I wrote, now I can develop it so that it can be a little bit more full. And so I loved it. Yeah. It was an interesting process, but you're absolutely right. It is so different. And I believe I adapted well to writing the mm-hmm. book, but it was an interesting challenge for me. And I loved it. I embraced it because it was something I hadn't tried before. So right. Yes, and I still love the poetry, but this was a blast to do. And I think this is sort of a mirror image of, just to go back to the singing for a minute, where, you know, I've been trained in singing opera, and well, can you sing it in a pop style? So I'm all open to trying new ideas and new concepts. And so I think maybe that's what changed in just my mental attitude, that don't be pigeonholed into a certain spot. Try new things, try different ideas in embellishing and in developing your art, whether it's the singing or whether it's the writing or whatever you choose to do. I think try new things.
Absolutely. And I think because you opened that door, so first of all, Past Life's Revenge, a David Harris and Emma Jackson mystery. The link will be in the show notes for people to check out. But you opened the door of bringing it back around to singing. And I asked you if you would. Now, I know, listen, the mic isn't ideal. The room isn't ideal. There isn't musical accompaniment. But there's something about, you know, there's something about like hearing a person who's trained in using their voice to sing. Would you do us the honor? And if you don't want to, I totally understand, but I would be absolutely delighted if you would.
Okay. So, okay, it's going to be raw, but I guess that's the whole point of this show. So I'd have to think.
That's the podcast.
Should I sing?
It's really unfair of me to do this to you.
It's all right. Another sip of water, because I talked a lot.
Sure.
Okay. Oh, bonnie woodland, I am sorry to see such a woeful destruction of your forest so green, and your hills were aplenty for many a long day, till the greedy men and builders all paved it away. All the birds in the forest, they bitterly weep, saying, where shall we shelter and where shall we sleep? For the oak and the ash, they are all cutting down, and the meadows where the fawns played are raised to the ground. Oh, bonny woodland, I am sorry to see such a woeful destruction of your forest so green. And if I had you now as I had before, all the greedy men and builders would not harm you anymore.
Angela, thank you. That was fantastic. Thank you. So good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shooting it raw?
Yes. Shooting it raw. Baby, I like